It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. So, this is one of those so moments. Evidently, world leaders came together over the weekend. The big group of 20 summits, all the countries coming together, all the main economies to basically issue a watered-down, real direction climate address that you just go, okay, we're going to get nothing done. That's what I'm getting. Nothing done. A few concrete commitments, if any, not going to help reach any goals at this point. In fact, Greenpeace, I think, said it best, that said the G20 leaders failed to meet the moment ahead of the COP26 climate conference that is going on in Glasgow. No commitments, no G20 commitments, nothing to reach zero carbon emissions by 2050, none of that stuff, nothing. But you did have British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leave it to Boris, who came up with the punchline, it's 1 minute to midnight, he said, and we need to act now. We have to move from talk and debate and discussion to concerted real-world action on coal, cars, cash, and trees. We need more trees, which is why in Biden's Build Back Better plan, you got the 300,000 climate folks that they want to bring in to do some of that stuff, building trees, do some Johnny Appleseed stuff. But this whole COP26, about 25,000 people going to participate this. In this big thing, sadly, I fear nothing's going to come out of it. Now, Joe Biden tweeted out today, the science is clear. We have only a brief window to raise our ambition, to rise to meet the threat of climate change. We can do it if the world comes together with determination and ambition. That's what the COP26 is about, and that's the case I made today in Glasgow. And great, this is fabulous. I love the fact that Joe Biden's talking about climate change. But immediately my mind went to Joe Manchin. Nothing's getting done without unelected President Joe Manchin, who is basically Lucy in the Charlie Brown skit again. And we knew he was going to be Lucy. This is not a surprise. No one should be surprised. No one. Because on the very day that this is all going on, and understand, over the weekend, you had a number of progressives coming out and swallowing the hard pill. Turns out that hard pill to swallow was poison. We're gonna go along with this much, much watered down plan. So what does Manchin do today? Kind of gives them the shot there in the you-know-where. He says, quote, simply put, I will not support a bill that is this consequential without thoroughly understanding the impact that it will have on our national debt, our economy, and most importantly, our American people. He then went on to wag the finger. He went on to point at progressives and warn them that holding the bipartisan infrastructure bill hostage, not going to work on him, not going to work on Joe. Because he's willing to let both of them tank. Understand that. And, what's frustrating in this is Manchin shows us, right where he's been. And he's been here all along. And I guess the argument is, well, so much for good faith. And this is why the progressives were leery to come along. And when they did, good shot in the back. He's been responsible for months of watering down the Build Back Better plan. Remember, it was $6 trillion to start. That was the big ambition. Nobody thought that was ever going to happen. But like any negotiation, you find some middle ground. So the middle ground would have been 3. That's what you do with Republicans to try and get them on board. Go, okay, well, what do you want? You do the horse trading. Joe Manchin got it done, said maybe 1.5, maybe 1.7. So Biden came all the way down to meet him. Said, okay, this is what you've said. We've taken out all the things you want. We've stripped everything out of it that you didn't want. No free college, no negotiating prescription drug prices, no dental, no vision for granny, none of that, all gone. And now he comes out and says, no, I'm not going to do it. And then the wagging of the finger, you progressives, don't do the bad thing. And you know, my thought was, well, you know, welcome to the circular firing squad. And this is why progressives were leery. They did. They swallowed the hard pill. I saw Ro Khanna this weekend come out and say, yeah, I'm going to support it. And like I said, that hard pill to swallow has turned out to be a poison pill. And understand, this is Biden's ACA. The difference is, as I said from the beginning, and I said this months ago, I don't think anything gets done. At least with the ACA, Obama got something. Now, granted, in the midterms, he got just beaten senseless with it, and Democrats ran away from it. This, I fear, Biden gets nothing on this end of it. And still going to get beat up for it. And this is where Democrats, you know, you just go, what? Now, understand, Joe Manchin is today's, you know, Joe Lieberman or Max Baucus, if you remember the ACA fights back in 10. That's who this is. And we knew this, didn't we? I mean, understand, we knew Manchin was going to do this. Because it's what he does. I actually thought, though, at some level, there would be a point where he goes, you know, now I'm going to get what I need to bring home to the people of West Virginia. If nothing gets done, the people of West Virginia are still one of the poorest states in the country. People will literally die. People will go hungry. Children will go hungry. Families will, well, continue to struggle as they have been. All because, well, you know, he has his want. And strategic pause. Now, look, I blame Joe Manchin. I blame Kyrsten Sinema. But I also blame the 50 Republicans who have made Joe Manchin possible. If we had a functional democracy that actually listened to we the people, where the issues mattered instead of the letter behind your name, we wouldn't need Manchin and Sinema. Because there would be other Republicans to go, you know what? I live in a poor state. Mitch McConnell, Kentucky, John Thune, South Dakota. You know, I live in a Joni Ernst, Iowa. I live in a poorer state. I've got people who need to put food on the table for kids. We've got seniors in our state that need glasses and chompers. Yes, we should be bringing some of this home. But, you know, as I was going through the list of Republicans, the old, stale old white man club with a couple of women and one black guy scattered in for good measure, I'm looking and I'm going, well, who? The Republican Senate has gone so extreme to the far right that, you seriously, Jim Snowball Inhofe, you think he's going to do anything on climate change? Chuck Grassley, who, seriously? And the answer is no, none of these people are the savior. You know, you would think, you know, Susan Collins, who likes to pretend like she's a moderate, maybe Lisa Murkowski. No, on this, they're lockstep. And understand, this stuff is popular. Negotiating prescription drug prices, really popular. That $250 a month for families with kids so they can make sure that there's food on the table or, you know, a little bit of extra income to keep them just a little bit ahead of the game, really popular on both sides of the political aisle. Even though the Republicans do say, well, socialism, but they'll go out, cash the check anyway. Don't see many of them returning it. And I'm just going down this list and I'm going, how'd the Republican Party become the party of scorched earth? How'd they become the party of the wealthy? Because that's what they really, that's where their allegiance really lies. If Democrats said, hey, we're going to give tax cuts to rich people, we're going to give it to Elon Musk, so that when Elon, you know, came out recently and said, you know, I'll sell $6 billion of Tesla stock if I could end hunger, and the UN has a plan to end hunger with $6 billion. You're not going to do it with $6 billion, sorry. But, you know, hey, you would think, even if we said we're going to give Elon Musk all the money, we're going to let Elon Musk end hunger, they'd still vote against it. Because it's benefiting those kids and those families and not Elon. It's crazy. Crazy times we're in. Which is why part of me goes, they're putting up with Joe Manchin's you-know-what, because one, Joe Manchin flips, and he's not going to, because he's in the most powerful position he's ever going to be in. He could become an independent tomorrow and still caucus with the Democrats and still be the outsider, the fly in the ointment, or, you know, the turd in the punch bowl. Probably more apt. But the reason that they're really trying to play with kid gloves with him is that Chuck Schumer this week is going to move forward. They're teeing up the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is going to help with our insane voting system. And what this part of it's going to do is going to go back and it's going to undo what our corporate Supreme Court hath done. In the Shelby case, and get rid of pre-clearance. It's going to go and it's going to re-put back into place all of the things in the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that the Supreme Court said, no, we're better than this now. We don't have those problems. No. Change whatever you want. And look what it's done. And they're hoping that, you know, maybe, possibly, oh boy. listen, you're not getting 10 Republicans to vote for this. It's going to die in cloture. And Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema are going to do nothing to end the filibuster, even on this, even though they have signaled that maybe there might be some discussion. Not going to happen. This is going to die just like everything else that is put forth that would actually be helpful. Because again, Joe Manchin. Now remember, now the reason I say that the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is going to die is because if you remember, at the beginning of the year, Congress put forth the For the People Act. And the House passed it. We were going to overhaul the entire voting system. And there was a lot of stuff in there, tons of stuff. They threw everything and the kitchen sink into it. With the idea that, you know, as we debate, you'll pull things out and you'll hone the bill down. You'll streamline it. And that's what Joe Manchin did. He watered it down like he did with the Build Back Better plan. And what it became then is not the For the People Act, but the Freedom to Vote Act. And look, there was some good stuff in there. There really was some good stuff. And it passed. It passed the House back in May. Over the summer, the Senate killed it twice. Again, why I believe the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is a pipe dream. But here's the thing, you know, Manchin's plan that he came out with, not bad. Expand early voting rights, do something on automatic voter registration, which we need. Make Election Day a holiday, which I've been calling for a very long time. If a polling place is changed, the state has to tell you 7 days before the election. So this would be a reason why to not keep changing polling places whenever. You know, make sure that those provisional ballots that people sometimes have to fill out actually get counted, even if they were cast in the wrong precinct, that you find the right one. And then some really good stuff on the other side, doing something with dark money, tightening disclosure rules, tightening a ban on the coordination between campaigns and these PACs, these super PACs. Require Facebook and other social media platforms and high-tech platforms to disclose political advertising. Probably not a bad thing. We should know who these euphemistically sounding groups, you know, Americans for Dogs and Puppies. We should know who's spewing this crap. all kinds of stuff. I mean, mandate, you know, money being handed off from foreign actors. I mean, you know, think about what was his name, Fortenberry. He got a bunch of money from the Nigerian Lebanese billionaire. When I first heard it, didn't you think it was one of those stupid chain emails? Do you think he got sucked into a chain email? No, this is the guy. They found him. This guy got a check. And there's a bunch of other things, like making sure the president and vice president divest from their businesses so they're not profiting off of sitting in the White House. Seems sane, rational, all kinds of things. There was some good stuff in here. And Joe Manchin said, if you let me strip that For the People Act thing down to nothing, I'll get you 10 votes. Guess what? Didn't happen. No 10 votes. And guess what? Voting rights legislation is dead. And for me, the most important piece of legislation is the voting rights stuff. Look, I want the Build Back Better plan. I think it's something we desperately need as a nation. I think it's an investment that we've been putting off for far too long. But you know, I'll go another year without it. If you give me the opportunity to have a fair fight, to go to the voters in November of 2022 and 2024 with a fair fight and run on the ideas of, hey, we need these investments. If you want to negotiate for prescription drug prices, if you want to expand Medicare for Granny to get chompers and glasses and hearing aids, if you want to make sure that no kid goes to bed hungry, if you want to make sure, you know, kids going off to college after high school get that free community college or that or voc tech training, you run on that. You vote for the people who want to bring it to you, not the people who have been sitting back going, no, we're not doing anything. We have no responsibility to govern. This is what the Republicans have been saying. The party of no has been saying this for a while. This isn't new. This is even when they were in power. They did nothing. Well, that's not true. They did hand a whole boatload of cash to our billionaires. They did hand off a boatload of cash to corporate America. Shareholder class, investor class, the Wall Street Journal folks. Wow. Fat and happy. Flush. Flush with cash and tax breaks. To the point to where, as someone emailed me this week saying, look, you make 25 grand a year, you pay almost as much taxes as a billionaire does. It's crazy. It's insane. It has to change. Question is, will we do it? I don't know. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day workers at International Harvester went out on strike. At the time, it was the UAW's longest strike. 35,000 UAW members at 21 plants in 8 states downed their tools. For 172 days, Harvester workers walked the picket lines over seniority rights and forced overtime. They had long resisted mandatory overtime rules. Workers at Harvester were the only UAW members anywhere who still enjoyed the 8-hour day, 5-day work week. They had no intention of giving that up, especially in the industrial downturn of the period that threw over 100,000 auto workers out of their jobs. Harvester argued the company had lost $1.3 billion in recent years because of work rules. The company hoped to force a concessionary contract. But 6 weeks into the strike, the company announced a 98% increase in profits for the year. 3 months into the strike, Harvester hinted it would drop its demand for forced overtime in exchange for part-time hires that would be non-union. The company also hoped to do away with seniority rights in job bidding. Despite injunctions that limited picket lines, strikers were able to minimize scabbing and shipments in and out of many plants. At a plant just outside Chicago, strikers
Attacking Local 6 members marched outside company offices with a burning effigy of hated Harvester president Archie McCardle, chanting no forced overtime. Victory finally came in April. Harvester workers stood tough for months against company attacks in a period of massive plant and mill closures across the country. They secured seniority rights in job bidding and beat back attacks against mandatory overtime. As for McCardle, brought in to slash and burn the union workforce, he was fired.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're in this spot where, you know, all I keep hearing from people is, Rick, Joe Biden's approval ratings are in the tank. It's terrible. They're terrible. And they're fixated on this to a degree where you go, look, you know, the reason that his approval ratings are down is because, well, guess what? This fight has been going on for all of this time. And look, it shouldn't be. This is something that, you know, Joe Manchin, our modern day Joe Lieberman, this is the position that he's put us in. And ultimately, there's work that's got to be done. And here to share some thoughts on, well, should we pay attention to the approval ratings? Is this something that that needs to be worked on? Is this something that eventually we get past? Is this, you know, something we need to, push forward on? I'm personally not a huge poll guy. I'm saying, you know, it would be great if we could possibly, you know, get what we need pushed through. And here to share some thoughts on that, I've asked Max Burns to come talk with us. Max is a Democratic strategist, also a columnist over at the Daily Beast. Max, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So walk me through this. The approval rating's not great. It looks like we're not getting the Build Back Better plan. Should we be fixed on the approval ratings?
Well, I think this is a really challenging moment because there are people who are using these approval ratings as reason to not go forward on legislation, when really these approval ratings are a sign that we have not delivered on legislation that people really want.
Yep.
And the answer is not to stop work or to keep cutting Build Back Better. The answer is to pass the original package people wanted.
And, you know, the thing that's infuriating to me is I've talked to so many voters recently who say, you know, if I don't get this, or if this isn't in the legislation, if we can't do something on voting rights or on free college or debt forgiveness, I'm staying home next time. And I'm going, you know, kind of the wrong message, kind of the wrong thing to do. But there's part of me that understands that in 2020, that's what they were told. We're going to get this done. You give us the majority. We get some of this stuff done.
Yeah, that's right. Joe Biden made some very big promises about what was coming. I think sort of overestimated in a way his ability to work the Senate on that thin a margin. But this is a bill that, at least as it stands tonight, there's a lot in this to be proud of. It's a historic bill by any measure, and any Democratic administration should be proud to have this stuff so close to being law.
Yeah, I mean, even if Lucy keeps pulling the ball away, there's still a lot in this. And look, I said this the other day. Look, do I want all of the other stuff too? Yeah, we can organize around getting that next time around. We get what we can now. We take the win. We put what we can into place. We make people's lives better. And you run on that.
You do. And there was a point, you know, as a progressive, there was a point in this negotiation process where the Build Back Better bill was not enough, where it was not doing what was promised. But this is a package of legislation that any of these individual things alone, universal pre-K, climate change funding, would be historic. And together, they completely changed the game.
Yeah. Now, you know, the first thing I thought when I saw Manchin's press conference, you know, basically wagging his finger at progressives, telling them, well, you better pass the other thing, was, you know, this is why progressives were afraid of, oh, just trust us. You know, we're negotiating in good faith. This, you know, immediately, because I saw Ro Khanna over the weekend saying, yeah, I'm going to vote for this, you know, basically swallowing the hard pill that we now find out is a poison pill.
Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head that there is very little trust anymore. And we saw tonight Joe Manchin saying very plainly that he is happy to vote against this $1.75 trillion Build Back Better plan, a plan that he largely negotiated to look like it currently does. But there doesn't seem to be any sense of who Joe Manchin is actually working for at this point.
Yeah. No, this reminds me of the ACA fight, where we let Max Baucus and Joe Lieberman and Republicans water down that bill to where we ended up getting not as much as we should have, and it wasn't as good as I wanted. And then you got the people who watered it down, not even voting for it. I mean, Chuck Grassley, a perfect example, kept watering it down and was never, ever, ever going to vote for it.
Yeah, and what baffles me so much is that this has been held for so long. This was something that Democrats knew would likely help Terry McAuliffe in Virginia, would help Democrats going into 2022. And the longer this is negotiated and cut down, the less positive effect we're going to see from it. And Joe Manchin doesn't have to worry about that in 2022. But you would think, from a party-building standpoint, that the president would certainly be pushing harder to get as much as he could as quickly as possible.
Yeah. Now, I look at this, and Joe Manchin says that he thinks that he's afraid it might be too much. And I'm going, you're in one of the poorest states in the country. I don't know that too much is too much when you're talking about one of the poorest states in the country, Max.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, 67% of Joe Manchin's constituents support this. Things like universal pre-K and providing health and dental coverage would change their lives. These are people who have made very clear in every forum we've allowed them to speak that they want these things passed. And the only thing that I can think to say is that there are two senators from West Virginia. I would like to see the media pressing Shelley Moore Capito as hard as they press Joe Manchin.
Yeah.
Because these Republicans are largely voting against things even their own voters have said they want.
Yeah, no, I've been saying this for a while. We're focusing on Manchin and Sinema, but there are 50 Republicans. And if we had a functional democracy, you wouldn't need Manchin and Sinema because there would be a handful of reasonable Republicans. But sadly, and I've gone down the list of the 50 Republican senators, there isn't any reason on that side. All of them are, their voting records have shown me that they are far right wing and even more afraid of the even further right wing primary challengers. They're never going to be any help.
And the fact that that is not a broader message from Democrats, it sort of surprises me. I mean, we see Mitt Romney, and he's getting this sort of fawning coverage from the media about how funny he was in his Ted Lasso Halloween costume. And here's Mitt Romney at the bipartisan dog costume contest. But Mitt Romney opposes universal pre-K. There are 50,000 children in Utah who lack access to a good preschool. How does he defend that to his voters? Why is that not every question he's receiving?
Max, this is the guy who was beating up on the 47% of working people in this country who don't pay federal income tax because they don't earn enough money to pay federal taxes. He was using them as the punching bag in one of his fundraising dinners. Do you really think he gives a rat's behind about their children? He didn't care about them or their children.
I don't think he cares. What I do think is that if more of his voters realize that he's actively standing in front of something that a majority of them want, that could completely change this dynamic. We've not in any way required these Republicans to play defense on this, and that is a shame because this is a broadly popular set of policies.
Boy, I wish we could have that conversation, but here's my problem. Here's my problem. What I'm stuck with when I hear Republican voters talk, I hear dumb stuff like, let's go, Brandon! I'm going, what is it? Is it stupidity? Is it jingoism? Is it you just want to cause headache and havoc? Because it sounds to me like most Republicans that I see in public don't seem to care about your kids, my kids. They don't even really care about their own kids.
They don't, and they couldn't tell you what they cared about. Republican values tend to shift based on whatever's coming out of Mar-a-Lago at this rate. We've seen them sort of jump between made-up scandals about Hunter Biden and COVID conspiracy theories. And now, you know, whatever is coming next. But what you won't see is them talking about these issues because they know they can't defend on that. And if Democrats force that discussion, we could find some surprising outcomes in 2022.
I hope so, because here's the thing. And this is what I've been saying. Our media culture has realized the Republicans, they're never going to vote for any of this stuff. And they've gotten the pass. I mean, really, can you look at any of the current U.S. senators who have an R behind their name and go, hey, here's one that would vote for children. Here's one that would vote for granny to get some new chompers. Here's one who thinks that kids should have the ability to go to community college. Here's one that's going to actually do something to make people's lives better. Can you name one of the 50? Because I'm looking at it. I'm looking at Rick Scott, who I think should be in jail. I'm looking at Marco Rubio. Are you kidding me? I'm looking at Richard Burr? Who's probably going to be going to jail? None of them.
Not one. And it's a real shame, because the entire reason we've slow played this Build Back Better plan is to indulge this fantasy from Joe Manchin that there are 10 Republicans who are just waiting to support universal pre-K. Yeah. It doesn't matter that they say they aren't. That's the reason for getting nothing done. And at least we're beginning to realize that this has always been just a smoke and mirrors game from him.
Yeah. Now, this week, Chuck Schumer says he's going to be rolling out the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. This is dead on arrival, but he's going to bring it out anyway. I shouldn't say that. Do you think that there's a snowball's chance in you know where of this ever passing?
I don't want to say no, but I'll tell you, I don't want to say no because I so deeply want this to pass. It's something that needs to pass. But realistically, you may have 3, maybe 4 Republicans who are willing to cross over and do this, but nothing near what you'd need. And they wouldn't do it for anything near like what that bill looks like right now.
Right.
And anything less is selling out voters we have sworn to protect.
Now, that's just the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act is just to undo what our Supreme Court did. Now, the thing that Manchin had said he was going to get 10 Republicans to vote on this Freedom to Vote Act, which I got to tell you has some good stuff in it. There's some things I really like. That didn't have a snowball's chance in passing. I don't see this happening either. So we're in this moment where do you continue to handle Manchin with kid gloves in the hopes that maybe we can carve out some filibuster stuff? Because I'll tell you, between you, me, and the four walls, the voting rights stuff to me is more important than the Build Back Better stuff.
Yeah, the voting rights is everything. Without voting rights secured, the next elections are just successive gains by Republicans who are able to increasingly rig maps in their favor. But I honestly don't see at this point what more you can push Joe Manchin on. He's proven completely unwilling to move. He's proven willing to flirt with leaving the party and becoming an independent. And one thing that we cannot have is a scenario where Mitch McConnell is somehow back as majority leader in the Senate. That would be the apocalyptic scenario.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to be a Republican. I've thrown it out a couple of times that, hey, you never know what McConnell has promised him. And you know McConnell is whining and dining and lining up donors for him as we speak. But I don't see Manchin going to the other side, because then he's just the 51st. He is the 51st senator, and he's not the one that he is now.
Yeah, he's instantly the least popular Republican in America.
Yeah. Although, you know, look at West Virginia. Couldn't hurt him there, and there's talk that he wants to run for governor and that all of this is about that, which is kind of weird to me, because wouldn't you have a better chance of winning as governor on a platform of, hey, look at all the bacon I brought home?
Yeah, I think it's always a popular campaign platform to say, I'm the reason your kids are getting an education. I'm the reason you can get your dental care and take care of your grandparents' health. That's a great platform to run on. It's mysterious to me. I don't pretend to know Joe Manchin's future political plans, but if he's doing that, there's certainly a calculus I don't understand.
No, he's got his own agenda, and it could be anything. I've had people say, oh, it's because he owns coal stock, his kids own a company, it's part of that. I go, I don't know, maybe he's part of it, but there's something above this. So willing to just really tank the Biden presidency and the Democrats' chances in 2022, it better be something better than just a couple of bucks in coal stock. Just my thought. Last question I've got for you, kind of changing gears. Evidently, the New York Fire Department's got about 2,000 firefighter jobs open now, huh?
Yeah, suddenly there's a big opening. And I'll tell you, it's an absolute shame. And it tells you how far things have gone from the idea that public servants should serve and protect the public. These are men and women who are normally the first on the scene responding to a crisis and trying to help people. And it's a real disappointment for our city that they've chosen to walk out instead of acting to protect their friends and neighbors.
Yeah. Now, I'm seeing stories on both sides. I'm seeing, you know, again, it depends on the source. That, you know, a whole bunch of people are, you know, at last minute going and getting vaccinated, that they're going, all right, fine. We want to keep our jobs. We'll get vaccinated. And then the other side is, oh, no, they're closing all the fire departments. And there are, you know, thousands of people who are, you know, doing all this stuff. What are we led to believe? Or is it somewhere in the middle?
Well, it depends on what your partisan slant is on your news. The reality is likely to be more muted. I think the relevant number is going to be what are those absentee numbers in a month, because that will give time for two doses and 2 weeks to have come in, and then anyone who's sort of lagging behind will be brought back into active service. So if we see, you know, 70-80% declines in a month, we'll know that this worked. Yeah, they had to be dragged a bit, but it worked. If it's still high in a month, I mean, that's a tough amount of resistance and something we haven't really thought about how to address.
Yeah, and time for us to start, getting some new fire people. I know a bunch of people who had dreams of being a fireman when they were kids.
It's a great job.
It is a great job, and one that, you know, a lot of people I know could never get. So there's some openings. If you ever want to be a fireman, there's openings. And look, you know, in Pennsylvania, they got a lot of volunteer fire departments, people who are qualified and, you know, that they want to move to New York and become a fireman. There's a push forward. But isn't it sad that something like this is what's caused this kind of chaos, and that simply, you know, protecting yourself and others, but more importantly, yourself, has become this kind of political football?
It is sad. And I've, you know, dug through this data throughout this pandemic, and there were a sizable plurality of people that had very reasonable hesitation, resistance to the vaccine, which is the wrong word to use for them. But they, as they got educated, we saw that group decrease. People got vaccinated. Yeah. What you're seeing now is really identity politics. It's anti-vax as a political badge of identification. Yeah. And I don't know how you engage or persuade that group.
Yeah, well, you made your choice. There's the door. Good luck. Max, I appreciate the time. Great stuff. Keep up the great work over there at the Daily Beast. Make sure you check out Max Burns' stuff over at the Daily Beast, where he writes his column. Max, thanks so much. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that bringing in a scab driver to run an elevated train in Brooklyn, New York, ended in tragedy. Members of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers were out on strike against the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company. The company had fired several union members for wearing union pins. To keep the trains moving, the company hired replacements and put them to work with little preparation. Edward Luciano received far less than the 60 hours of training that operators typically received before he made his fateful run. The next day, the New York Times reported on the deadly results, writing, quote, "A Brighton Beach train of the Brooklyn Rapid Transit Company made up five wooden cars of the oldest type in use, which was speeding with a rush hour crowd to make up lost time on its way from Park Row to Coney Island, jumped the track shortly before 7 o'clock last evening on a sharp curve approaching the tunnel at Malbone Street in Brooklyn, and plunged into a concrete partition between the north and southbound tracks. At least 93 people died. Some estimates were more than 100 killed. The operator and several company officials were eventually put on trial for manslaughter. No one was found guilty. The company did, however, pay out damages to some of the families. Negotiations between the company and the union would continue until 1920. The union eventually won most of its demands. In the years after the crash, new safety measures were implemented for elevated trains to help guard against human error.
Oh, the workers on the SP line to strike sent out a call. But Casey Jones, the union's cabbie, wouldn't strike at all. His boilers, they was leaking.
For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's Tucker Carlson Day. Today is the day the Tucker Carlson propaganda reel drops on some Fox streaming network somewhere. And I can't wait to not see it. Because evidently, according to the Fox Tucker Carlson propaganda reel trailer, we're hunting white people. Not only are we hunting white people, we're dragging them off to Guantanamo Bay. We're waterboarding and torturing them. We're doing all kinds of stuff. Bad stuff. All because, you know, January 6th was a false flag. While simultaneously being a walk in the park, a frat party, just another day, or the most patriotic day in American history, depending on which propaganda thing you're consuming. And I got to tell you, the rewriting of January 6th is really troubling to me, especially because, well, Democrats have been so slow, in my view, of prosecuting these criminals, members of Congress, the moneyed interests, and our judicial system has just simply sucked on this. Slap on the wrists at best, it's infuriating. And here to share some thoughts on, well, our January 6th problem. And as he points out, you don't need to be Perry Mason to find January 6th conspiracy, just the courage to pursue it. And do we have the courage? That's why I've asked Will Bunch to come talk with us. Will is a daily columnist over at the Philadelphia Daily News and Inquirer. Will, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So I love that line. You don't need to be Perry Mason to figure this stuff out.
It's funny, in the column, actually, I pointed out, not only do you not need to be Perry Mason, you don't even need to be Hamilton Berger, which is one of the great TV names of all time. Hamilton Berger was the DA who lost every case, except one, famously, but lost every other case to Perry Mason in the entire history of the show. But you know what? Hamilton Berger could have made a conspiracy case against these guys.
Yeah, he was the Washington Generals of basketball.
Exactly. Washington Generals. I love it.
But this is one of those things, though. I mean, you know, by not pursuing this aggressively, as we should have on January 6th and 7th, and by having the kind of slap on the wrist, couple of months in jail, maybe some probation, a little fine, we're playing right into the rewrite, the propaganda being put forth by people like Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, my big issue on this is, why are we not going after the bigger fish, you know? And I mean, of course, obviously Donald Trump is the biggest fish, but put him aside for a second, you know? I mean, what about Rudy Giuliani? What about John Eastman, this lawyer who worked with Giuliani and the rest of the team who wrote up this memo? What about Steve Bannon, who obviously has something to hide, which is why he's not testifying? What about Roger Stone, who clearly is a confidant of Donald Trump and who was pardoned by Trump just days before January 6th and was photographed multiple times in D.C. with leaders of the Proud Boys? What about Michael Flynn? I mean, I could go on and on. I could give you, 15 high-level names, including some of these members of Congress who we know a little bit less about their January 6th activities, but we know enough that they should at least be investigated, right? And I mean, this whole debate about I think, what is it, 600 or 800 of the, what you might call the little fish of January 6th have been charged so far. And, you know, I'm not a big mass incarceration guy. So if somebody entered the Capitol and didn't fight and do physical violence, I'm okay with them getting 6 months or whatever, but they're not who I'm interested in. I mean, obviously anybody who assaulted the police officer should be charged and penalized the way that American society penalizes all the other people who, get convicted of assaulting a police officer.
Yeah, here's my problem with that, Will. We walk into a post office, we break into a post office, you're going away for 5 years without even a question. You break into the U.S. Capitol with the intent, and everybody there, stop the steal, they knew what they were walking in there for. They were there to stop the certification of the presidential election. To me, that is a much bigger crime than just walking into a post office. But if you and I walk into a post office unauthorized, we're going to jail for a long time.
Well, I mean, Rick, we're liberals, you know, so, or progressives or whatever we are this week. But yeah, we're not conservatives, so it's a little different, right? No, I'm kidding, but I hear you, but I guess my point here is that, you know, this debate about how these 600 people are being punished, the real question for me is, what is the Justice Department doing? What is Merrick Garland doing? We don't know. I mean, for all we know, they'll surprise us in 3 months with this mega indictment that includes Trump and everybody. But I don't think we're really seeing the signs that there's an aggressive, high-level conspiracy investigation going on. When, you know, many legal experts, the more they look at this, say there is clearly a case for a broader conspiracy. I think you heard an argument last week that fraud may have been committed by these people in their efforts to undo the election. This John Eastman. I mean, the thing is, every day we're getting a new report, and a lot of this is confirming stuff that's already out there. I mean,
exactly.
this whole Willard Hotel thing kind of drives me nuts in a way, because I mean, there were pictures of these activities at the Willard Hotel were online in January.
And
people like these internet sleuths like Seth Abramson, who some people love him and some people don't love him or whatever. But, you know, I mean, he's pieced together who was at these meetings. And it's a who's who of everybody. They were in a war room. They were in a war room because they were launching a war. They were launching a war on democracy, and that's why they had a war room. And
yeah,
if we're not going to do anything about that, you know.
No, I mean, you couple this with the actions of Trump, you know, and you've got the audio recording of him, you know, telling the Secretary of State in Georgia to basically go searching through the couch cushion and find me 12,000 votes so that I can get what I need to put the plan that we now have seen in writing by Attorney Eastman into practice, so that on January 6th, they can have their military go in and overthrow this. There's a straight line here for me, because I don't know if you've seen the videos of the guys who are all dressed up in their military garb, hand on the shoulder, marching up and getting into formation. They didn't just, we want a better vantage point to look. They strategically placed themselves in positions to do exactly what they did. You don't just have a gallows in your trunk that just pops up out of nowhere. I'm sorry, that's not how this plays out.
Yeah, I mean, these Oath Keepers that you were referencing here, I was writing about them back in 2010. I did a book called The Backlash about the Tea Party movement, which was kind of the, cousin of the Trump movement. And, you know, these people, you know, I mean, they're blowhards on some level, but it reached the point where they decided they weren't going to be all talk, that they were going to do something. And you're absolutely right. It's pretty scary. And, and I'm glad you mentioned the thing about Trump and the phone calls to Georgia, and he was doing the same thing here in Pennsylvania, right? And because, again, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a legal authority, but I know enough about conspiracy to know that you have to have, you know, two or more discrete acts, right, to do something. So to me, I look at you know, these phone calls to the Raffensperger in Georgia and some of the other officials, this is election tampering. He's the president of the United States with tremendous political and governmental power, telling them to find votes, which is, you know, fraud, basically, you know, and it's definitely election tampering. So that's one discreet act. And then short of that, he's on the internet telling people to come, you know, Trump is telling people to come to Washington on January 6th, that it's going to be wild. Steve Bannon is working with him on his podcast, telling people, you know, that it's going to be, you know, crazy and the whole thing.
All hell's going to break loose.
All hell's going to break loose. That's the phrase I was looking for. But, it's a conspiracy, Rick. I mean, come on. I mean, that's all there is to it. And so.
And it's just not January 6th, Will. It's not just for that day. You know, I look at this most recent poll put out by the researchers at the Public Religion Research Institute. They've come out and said that 39% of Republicans, of Trump voters, believe violence may be necessary. True American patriots may have to resort to violence to save American democracy. This is, and look, not just 39% of Republicans, 11% of Democrats, 17% of independents. The pot is boiling to this point to where there could be even more bloodshed in the street because of this insanity.
Yeah, I mean, to this movement, you know, they're not seeing January 6th as the be all and end all. They're seeing January 6th as the kind of Munich beer hall putsch, you know, kickoff, right? And now we're seeing, I mean, thank God we haven't seen an event like January 6th, but it feels like we're seeing the buildup to something, you know. My last couple of columns, you know, you referenced the one about the January 6th conspiracy, but my next column was about exactly this, you know, the increasing violence, embrace of violence on the far right.
Right, which brings me to the trial this week of that Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yeah.
You have a column on this, and I think it's important that people understand that all of this stuff plays together. It's all intertwined in the rewriting of history and events. And look, you know, the right is looking at this Rittenhouse trial as, you know, he's going to be the savior of the moment. He's going to be their icon. And you could see it already lining up into places.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, you can't. I mean, even if he's found guilty, which, you know, with this wacko judge running the case, I'm not really sure that's going to be perhaps tough to pull off. But, you know, if Rittenhouse is found guilty, he's going to be a martyr. And if he's found not guilty by reason of self-defense, he's going to be even more of a hero to these people. You know, I mean, I think the reactions are already locked in, you know, and, you know, but it's important. I mean, this is basically, this isn't just a trial of a teenager. This is a trial on vigilantism. And if that's going to be allowed in the streets of America.
Yeah. Now, know? Here's the thing, Will, and I'm sure you probably know them too. I know people who it's their fantasy. They are waiting for the next civil war. They've been, you know, I know a guy who's been storing rice and guns all over the central region here in Pennsylvania because that day's coming. We're going to have to rise up. And they think that they're going to refight the battles of old, only this time going to get the right outcome.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's always a mindset. You know, you've always got that kind of Civil War mindset out there. And what's different from people who maybe thought that way 20 or 30 years ago is now you have people like Donald Trump or like other higher ups in the Republican Party who, instead of trying to tamp down this rhetoric, you know, encourage it. I mean, the classic example that gets talked about a lot is the mid-60s with the John Birch Society. And, you know, for all their flaws, and they had many flaws, but you know, William F. Buckley or even Barry Goldwater, who was, I think, a little bit less flawed, but flawed, you know, they at least tamped down the most dangerous extreme elements on the far right. I'm not celebrating what they accomplished, but right, at least that was the momentum, you know. And there's nothing like that now. I mean, you know, nobody's, you know, you've got the leaders of the party out here chanting "Let's go, Brandon," which means that's my next column, by the way.
It's not even the leaders. I was at a hockey game the other night, and you got Nitwits running around screaming that, like they're in on something that nobody else understands.
Well,
and you go,
well, their entire political movement is based on owning the libs, right? And it really stands for nothing else, you know. As I'm pointing out in this column that I'm working on tonight, I'm writing right now. But I mean, you've got a situation where zero Republicans on Capitol Hill will vote to do anything about climate change, which is threatening mankind. Zero Republicans on Capitol Hill think that America should join every other nation in offering paid family leave. Zero Republicans on Capitol Hill think that America should do something about the fact that we're one of the world's laggards on offering child care to under five children in this country, or that we have this outrageous extortionary higher education system in this country. All they care about is grievance and resentment, and they love this chant because they can say, "See how triggered you are," and it's always damned if you do. You can ignore it and it just gets worse, or you can respond and then you're a snowflake, we're owning you. It's like their game.
I responded. I said, "You're showing me your 60 IQ. Keep it up. You go, buddy. Yeah. Go, Brandon, and take you with him."
Yeah, but the problem, the problem is, if you're playing their game, whether you win or lose, the game should be helping out the middle class in this country, and they're not playing that game at all.
That is such an important point, because all of the stuff in this Build Back Better plan that should be going through, that is overwhelmingly popular, would help these people, especially, some of the ones that I see, saying these idiotic chants. It would actually help their lives get better. And yet, no, we got to own the libtards, even if it means my kids don't eat.
Yeah. Or, I can't go to work. I can't go back to work because I don't have childcare, or, my kid's going to fall behind, your kid's falling behind because he doesn't have pre-K. And then if he makes it through high school, he can't afford community college, let alone, 4-year college anyway. So, I mean, that's the America, and the thing is, the more people get locked out of opportunities because they don't have higher education or they don't have these things, the more resentful they get. It's a spin cycle, and it's tragic for the country.
No, you are absolutely right. It's just one of those things that makes you go, wow, where do you go from here? But Will, I appreciate you taking some time. Great work you do over there at the Philly Inquirer. I hope folks will take a look at the work of the January 6th conspiracy is hiding in plain sight, written by my good friend Will Bunch. Will, keep up the great work. Love having you on. Hope you'll come back again real soon.
Oh, anytime. I love coming on, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff. Seriously, make sure you check out Will's work over there at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
If you're a fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in 2 segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor History has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible 2-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. Generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today. Here at The Rick Smith Show, we don't accept corporate advertising. Never have, never will. In fact, we spend most of our time giving corporations the finger. We don't stop the show every few minutes to sell you supplements, beet juice, or whatever snake oil the right-wing loonies are pawning. That's because we're not sellouts. It's also because we're supported by our friends in labor and by people like you. If you like what we do, become a patron by going to patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. That's patreon.com/Rick Smith Show. Give what you can, if you can, and help us fight for the working class majority. Because together we bargain, divided we beg. Thank you for tuning in.